This is the start of the July 31st, 1986 interview with shrimp fisherman and boat builder Charles Herron of Jacksonville, Florida. The interviewer is David Taylor, and this interview is done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project.
Good job.
Probably Lisa will have some questions for you later on too, but we'll just go ahead with this. Now to begin with, Charles, can you tell me when your birthday is and where you were born?
My birthday is September 5th. I was born 1940.
And where was that?
I was born in 1940. The place I was born was Charlton County, which is Folkestone, Georgia, is the county seat of Charlton County. But I was raised all over the woods back there, you know, from Folkestone to between Folkestone to Hunter.
Was there a community there? Or what was that place called near where you
were? Well, Folkestone was a little town.
Yeah.
But that was the county seat I was raised in. Actually, in Winoka, Georgia, mm-hmm. which is probably halfway between Folkestone and Hunter, Georgia. From there to a place we call Riverside Road. We lived all back in there. But we farmed some. Not in a whole lot, but we farmed some. When we lived out on the Riverside Road, we farmed a little.
How big was your family?
There were six of us, four boys and two girls.
And your dad was mainly a farmer, that's how?
No, he did farm some, but yeah. It wasn't mainly a farmer. He did a lot of logs, cut logs and cross ties and put wood and dip turpentine and this kind of stuff, but whatever, you know, you could get to do. Yeah. You know, back then.
Right.
But for strictly farm, no, he didn't.
Yeah.
Some years he'd farm, and some years he'd work doing other things.
Did he grow up around there himself?
Yeah. Same area.
Yeah. And your mother, too?
No. My mother grew up in, can't think of it, a little town. A little small town, though, in Georgia, but
yeah.
not right around there. But not too far from there.
Did both your parents died not too long ago?
No, just my dad died, and then her mother died.
That's right, yeah.
Well, her mother died first, and then daddy.
Mm-hmm.
11 days between them, I think. 12 days.
Hmm. Well, when you were, now, how did you fit in terms of the ages of the children in your family?
Well, I was the fifth one. No, I actually was the sixth one. It was seven, but one lived 3 days, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually the sixth one.
Oh, yeah. How old is Thomas and how old is Donald?
Thomas is 52. And Donald is 48.
Yeah.
Hey, I can't hardly keep up my own age.
Sometimes that's the best way to go, too.
Yeah.
Well, what did you figure you'd be doing for a living when you were growing up? Did you think about that very much?
Well, I was thinking about running for president, but I changed my mind about that. You know, I don't know. I never did really know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something besides lay pipe, you know, for somebody. I wanted to do something for myself, but I didn't know what.
Well, when did you first get involved with fishing? How old were you then?
was about 10, 11 years old. We lived in a little old settlement then, just out of Fernandina, a little piece. And man had a little store there, right next to the door to our house. And he had a little small river boat. And he wanted us to, me and Dawn, wants to go with him in the river and help him catch bait shrimp. Because he sold bait at the little store also. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into it.
What was that boat like that he had?
A little small boat, about 35 feet or something, 30 feet, 30, 35. And one had that Model A engine in it that backfired, blew it up, and caught a fire. I tried to swim to the hill. Likely drowned it before I got there. Donald threw me that line about 2-inch in diameter line. He was just a kid, too. And that thing would go about 4 or 5 feet. I tried to reach for it and couldn't. But that's how I got started on that little thing.
That's a heck of a beginning on a boat that catches fire.
Yeah, it was. It was a beginning, all right.
Well, how long did you fish with this guy?
Oh, just while the shrimp was real small, he caught them for bait, so it wasn't but maybe a month or so. And I never did do that no more until I got about 16, I guess it was. Thomas wanted me to go with him to Fernandina. We lived in a different spot by the time I got that age, and he wanted me to go with him to Fernandina to get a job on a big boat,
yeah.
Which the boat wasn't all that big, but then it was. It was 56 feet,
mm-hmm.
And back then that was a super trawler. And he wanted me to go with him then, and get a job on a big boat and fish in the ocean. So I did. And worked there probably 3 or 4 months and stayed so seasick that it was pitiful. But I toughed it out a while and I said, I don't think I can hack this no more. So I quit. When the job got me a job on the hill. But and then later on in the years, I said, well, you know, I want to try it again. So I started building a little small boat, a little steel hull boat. Got that thing finished and used it just a little bit, and I'll sell it and get me a bigger one. I thought I'd done got to be pro by that time, you know. So I advertised it, and this guy lived out here on Hexshire Drive and had a bigger boat, wood boat.
Mm-hmm.
He traded me even. So I started with that thing. Then sold it. I said, well, I'll build me a wood boat. So then that's when I built the Miss Fergie. It was up there.
She's gone.
It's gone now.
What big was she?
46 feet.
Is that the one you built right here?
Yeah, right outside there.
Yeah.
And then I sold it. And I said, well, I ain't going to build no more boats. So I bought another one. Kept me it, which is a big boat. Kept it for 10 years. And then I said, well, I'm going to build one more. So that's when I built the Miss Julian.
Now, you were fishing when you were doing this building, too?
Yeah, I was fishing the... No, not the first one, no. I worked on the hill.
What were you doing?
I was a counter sales clerk. I worked on the counter selling industrial parts and stuff like that.
Okay.
Now, I did that for 12 years.
What company was that for?
Irvington Moore.
Uh-huh. I've heard you say this a number of times, and I'm not sure we've talked about it or not, but I've heard other fishermen say it too, about going on the hill or working on the hill. Now, what does that mean, to be on the hill?
Well, it's just an expression, I guess, when you're not in the water, you're on a hill, you know. If you're not on water, you're on land. So
uh-huh.
We just use that expression, you know, is hill.
Be on the hill. Just means being back on
just
land.
Means back on land and working on a job that's on land, mm-hmm. You know, instead of in the water.
Yeah. Well, how did you learn about building boats, like that steel boat? That sounds like quite a project. You've never done it before.
I didn't learn. I never did learn something before I tried it. You know, I learned while I was trying it.
Yeah.
I just, if I decided to do it, I just started at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what it's supposed to look like, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
But knowing what something looked like and put it together is a different story.
Yeah. Well, how did you, speaking of what it should look like, how did you come up with the design before you started putting the parts together?
On the first one, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've seen boats just about all my life. And I just had a picture in my mind what the thing's supposed to look like. And started from that.
Did you use any drawings or
no.
patterns or anything? And that was that welded or bolted? Or?
That was welded.
Yeah.
It was all solid steel. Everything on it was steel.
Mm.
Now, this wood boat that I built, this last one, you know, I drawed on it a long time. And I built it to the print that I drawed up.
Well, tell me about how you did that, and what would you have to do to draw that design? What kinds of things would you want to put down, and how did you come up with those things?
Well, there's a lot involved when you're drawing one. More involved than what most people realize. Because once you start the thing, when you start drawing the thing, it's got to be in such a way until it's got to go together like a puzzle. I mean, you don't just draw a picture of a boat and build it to that picture. It just don't work that way. You got to have a certain depth in the stern of it. You got to have a certain depth in the bow of it. And you got to draw the bottom where when it sets in the water, that stern will go down lower than the bow of it. And you got to decide on how much power you're going to put in it, what kind of engine. You got to draw your engine beds in there. They got to be in the right spot for weight. If it's too far forward, then the boat goes too much to the bow. If it's too much stern, then it goes too much toward the stern. The right width. The engine beds has got to be right width, and the engine is set on top of the beds instead of in between. And there's a lot to it besides just drawing a picture of a boat and starting. Mm-hmm. Every little piece of it has got to be figured and calculated and scaled out.
Well, when you started doing the drawing, what would you do first?
What part would I draw first?
Yeah.
I would draw the shaft log, which is the thick, heavy piece right in the stern that the stern sits on.
Mm-hmm.
I would draw that piece first, and then the keel, and then attach the bow stem to it on the angle that the boat is supposed to sit on.
Mm-hmm.
In the water.
Doing it
right.
Horizontal.
Right.
Yep.
In other words, you got a level line that you use for the water line, and then you draw the boat to that level line. But the keel and the shaft log and all that is on an angle from that level line. And we're going to use that level line as the water line.
Mm-hmm.
And if you set the molds in there according to that, then the boat is going to sit that way when you put it in the water.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the shaft log and the keel and the stem.
Right.
Then what do you draw?
Then you more or less draw the shear of the deck.
Mm-hmm.
From that same level line that you got on there that we're using as a water line. You draw your deck from that line too, because you want your bow deck part of it to stick up more than the stern. You know, you go through some seas, you want that bow to knock all that off.
Mm-hmm.
So you draw from that level line again, and you get that part on. And then you draw your house where you want the house set, way up forward or back, or that's whatever suits your fancy on that. It don't really matter where you put it, just whatever looks the best to you. But the rest has got to be drawn according to scale or the way that boat's going to sit. Now that's what you draw when you want to look and see what the boat looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you want to draw a scale of the moles, then that's another question. You got to do a lot of measuring from that same straight line that I was telling you about as waterline down to the bottom of the keel. You get that distance. And when you draw your mole, you draw a, like the rib's going to be up to that waterline. And then most all boats sit where this, we'll just say the square part of the bottom and the sides meet. Mm-hmm. Most all boats sit right in that area within 6 or 7 inches. Mm-hmm. So you draw that rib or that mole to that same square line. Mm-hmm. And then when you put the thing in there on top of the keel, the real thing, and then you fasten all your ribs and all according to that shape. When you set the boat in the water, it sits just like you draw it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of figuring.
Yeah. And how long did it take you to finally draw up the design that you thought was the one you built?
How long did it take me to draw it up?
Yeah, from the time you started to the time you finished and said, well, this is it now.
2 years.
Really?
It wouldn't have taken me that long, but I drawed on it probably a year and a half, maybe, anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe longer than that. Mm-hmm. Just once in a while I would draw on it, so. But I was still shrimping the cap mid.
Oh, yeah.
All the time I was drawing.
Yeah.
And I would draw a little bit, and then I might not draw no more than for a few days, and I'd think about it.
Did you do that right here at home?
Yep.
Yeah.
Hanging on the kitchen wall.
Why would you put it up there?
Or I could back off out and look. I would draw a little bit and I would stand back and look at it. And I could see the shear of it good. You know, if you stand back, mm-hmm. you can see the lines of it good. Mm-hmm. If I just had it down on a desk, well, you couldn't tell that much about it.
Now, we've talked about this a little bit in the past, too, especially when I came to see you in your building, about the particular shape of the hull of your boat. What were your reasons for choosing that kind of a design?
Because it don't roll in a swell as bad as a round bottom boat will roll. And it's more stable in the water than the round bottom. And the ribs last longer on a chine bottom than they will on a knuckle bottom. Because if you build a round bottom one, you got to have the oak rib to do it, and you got to boil at it, or steam it, or boil it in a vat of water mm-hmm. to get that rib so it'll bend to make that round. And when you do a piece of wood like that, you cutting down on the life of that wood.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll go bad a lot quicker. So the chine bottom just lasts a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. Is it easier to build that way too?
No, no, it's not really easier. I think it's maybe a little harder.
Yeah, how come?
Because you got more pieces to fit in there that you don't have on a round bottom boat. Mm-hmm. But when you put a chine boat, you got the rib in two pieces. And then you got the inside knuckles and the outside knuckles to fasten to the corner of that chine. And plus your stiffeners. And if you build a round bottom one, you don't have all that. When you get the rib bent in there, you're through with it. Then you just put your stiffeners on it. You don't have all those inside knuckles and outside knuckles to put. I think it's easier to build a round bottom.
Mm-hmm. I heard you say one time something about a watermelon boat. What is that?
The round bottoms I call is watermelon. They roll just like a, if you take a watermelon and cut it in half and, you know, it's going to roll and roll and roll like a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way a round bottom boat is. It rolls like a watermelon. Mm-hmm. And the chine bottom boat don't do that. It'll roll. You know, a chine bottom will roll too. But it takes more of a sea to roll it.
Mm-hmm.
It won't roll as far over. It'll roll over a little quicker.
Have the boats that you've owned before the Miss Joanne, what kinds of shapes did they have? Were they like the one you have now?
No, it was round bottom.
All of them?
Not all of them.
Yeah.
The steel hull was a chine boat. And then the Shenandoah was around bottom. And then the Miss Virgie was chime boat. And then the Captain Ed was around bottom. And now the Miss Joanne, she's chime bottom. Mm-hmm. So I've had equal number of both kinds, and mm-hmm. the chime boat is just a better boat. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion of it anyway.
Yeah, well, if you've tried them all, you
should try
them.
Know
by now.
Yeah.
Let's see now. Of course, I've seen the boat as it's progressed, the Miss Joanne, but could you just briefly tell me what the steps of construction are, the things that you did in order to build it from start to finish? What were the most important things that you did when you were building her? How would you start then from there?
You mean the most important thing or
the
steps?
The steps, yeah, that's a better way to put it.
Yeah, because there's a lot of important things that I took some time in doing. But the steps is more or less about like I told you, I drawed it. You would build a shaft log, which is the heavy piece in the stern. You build that first. And you set that on top of the keel. And you get you a bit made up, a special, we always use a steel bit, but you can use a wood bit, but the steel bit is a little better. Get it made up with a long extension on it, about 5 foot extension. And you drill through all of that wood, 4 or 5 feet thick wood. And it takes a while to drill that stuff too.
This is all by hand?
This is all by hand. You drill through there and you put stainless bolts in it. Bolt that together. Then that's sitting on top of the keel now when you drill all this stuff. And then you, while it's laying down flat, and then you cut the bow stem out. Cut mine out in two pieces so I could have a curve in the bottom and not just a straight knot on the bottom. So we cut that out and bolted up. And then we got 8 or 10 people out there, and we stood it up, braced it up, and then you take some 2x4s and build 4 stages molds and set them on top of the keel and fasten it down, drive stakes in the ground and whatever you can hang on to keep them molds from moving, because if it moves then your boat's out of shape. So you get all that done. And that's basically, however that turns out, that's the way the boat's going to look. Then you just build to that. It's like more or less putting siding on a house. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, it's a little more complicated than that because it's got some round shears and twist in the boards and this kind of thing. But it's more or less covering up the cracks, you know, when you get all that done to it. Mm-hmm.
So after the molds are replaced and braced, What would happen after that?
You start putting the ribs in it. You put the bottom ribs in first. All the bottom. We put all the bottom in first, and then we come along and hook the side ribs to that and get all that standing up and start putting the stiffeners and things in the bottom, keep the thing from moving, and then stick the deck beams on it that you set the deck on. And get all that bolted down. Every piece has got to be bolted, 1 to 2 bolts in every piece of it. Wherever you drive a nail, there's a bolt there too, you know. And I put a lot of bolts in this Miss Joanne. Mm-hmm. In fact, I put more bolts in it than it really needed, really, you know. But I didn't want the thing to come apart.
Yeah. And after you've got your deck beams in, what happens after that?
Well, we started putting deck on it. Mm-hmm. After we got the deck beams in, because we figured we'd be under the shade sometimes.
Yes.
You know, we was working on the bottom and stuff. But then you put the sides on. Put the bottom on very last. It's the last thing you do. Because all that trash and sawdust and shavings and stuff that, you know, you're working on the top side is going to fall down. And if you got the bottom on, pretty quick, when by the time you get through with the boat, it's going to be full of sawdust and stuff. So you put that on last. and get it painted up, corked up good, and a few 10,000 other minor things that you do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically the size of it.
What were the types of wood that you used, and where did you get them?
I got it from sawmill, straight from the sawmill. It was all cut green.
What sawmill was that?
I got some of it from Franklin Lumber in Hilliard, mm-hmm. Florida, and I got some from Blyler Sawmill over in Dinsmore. And I used a live oak bough stem, and I used a pine keel with pine ribs, cypress planking, and of course the plywood I didn't get from the sawmill. You know, you got to get it already made, but I used fir plywood, glassed over,
mm-hmm.
for the deck and the pilot house.
Mm-hmm.
So it's oak and pine.
You said that wood was green. Was any of it dried apart from the plywood?
The planking was.
Yeah.
The planking was dry. the planking had dried for 3 years, air dried for 3 years. The planking on it's got to be dry.
And who was it you got the planking from?
I got it from Blyler Sawmill.
Oh, yeah.
In Dinsmore.
Mm-hmm.
He had cut a bunch of it. And he said he had some good logs come in one time, and he said he'd saw it up for some lumber somebody may want some one day. So he sawed it up and stacked it up. And I just happened to catch him when he had it.
Yeah, that sounds fortunate.
Yeah, because it's hard to get.
Yeah.
Good cypress is hard to get. You can get plenty of cypress, but not good cypress.
If you hadn't found him in that supply, what would you have done?
I got cypress in Barberville.
Yeah.
That you can get for, you know, boat cypress.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, tell me it's kind of expensive.
Yeah.
But you can get it right on. It's just kind of hard.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back now to just before launching it, when you were getting it all ready to go, closing in that bottom there. Was there anything you did for good luck or anything you put on the boat for good fortune?
Yeah, well, you know, it's always been a tradition when you put a boat, before you put it in the water, you break a bottle of champagne on it, which is just a good luck tradition. I don't see why you couldn't break a bottle of, you know, ginger ale on it, but that might not give me quite as good luck. So.
Before that day, which I think was October 15th, in putting the keel pieces together or anything inside, I know some boat builders I've talked to in the past have put things, like objects, under pieces of the wood and stuff.
I just about forgot. We put a quarter.
Yeah.
There's a quarter underneath the front of the pilot house studs. And it's all closed in now. You won't ever see it unless somebody tears the front of the pilot house off and get down to the bottom end of that stud that sits up there. But there's a quarter there.
Was that any special quarter?
No, wasn't a special one.
Yeah.
It was just an old quarter come right out of my pocket.
Is that something you've seen other fishermen or boat builders do?
No. But we turned it heads up, too. But I'd about forgot about that.
Oh, yeah.
And another good luck thing is when a boat builder builds a boat, he's built a stern east and west. You know, or it don't really matter where the stern is the one way or the other, as long as the boat is setting east and west.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be good luck.
Oh, yeah. Did you do that?
Yeah, pretty much. It wasn't exactly, you know, east and west, but it was. It was in that vicinity. It was pointing in them directions.
Did you think about that at the time when you were setting it up?
No, not really.
Yeah.
I didn't hear about that until after I got it set up.
Oh, really? I haven't heard about that one either. I just got to turn the tape over here.
End of side one. Interview continued on side two. side two of tape one of the July 31st, 1986 interview with Charles Herron.
There we go. Speaking of good luck and bad luck there, up where I grew up in Maine, there were a lot of builders of boats, and they had things that they did for good luck and bad luck that had to do with the colors they painted boats to.
Oh, yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you don't want to put no green on the boat.
Why not?
Green is bad luck on a boat.
Any place
paint,
on the boat?
Yeah, any place. You know, just don't want no green.
Huh.
But the nets you catch the shrimp with is green. So, but it's just one of them things they dream up. Somebody had some bad luck with a green boat one time.
Yeah.
So let's figure bad luck don't put no green on.
Any other colors? Just green?
Just green mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a lot of words, you know, you don't say on a boat.
Like what?
Alligator.
You're not on a boat, so you can say that.
Right? Yeah, I'm sitting in there, I don't care. But you do not say alligator on a boat. Well, you have a pile of bad luck. You don't have no shells on there.
No shells?
No shells on the boat. You don't turn the hatch cover all the way up, upside down.
Mm-hmm.
You don't carry no black suitcase on the boat.
Hmm.
You don't whistle.
I didn't do that the other day, did I? I don't think so.
I don't think so, but when I made my little trips, I had my little black bag and I put it on the boat and took off.
Oh, yeah.
Like starved to death, too. Maybe that was the reason.
But do you hear stories that explain why people believe these things?
Yeah.
Like what?
The shell story now. Well, in fact, this boy used to work with me on the Miss Virgin. He was out there dragging one night, and he was on the stern, and he hung up. So he run up there and cut the engine down, and took him a while to get off the hang, and started dragging again. Engine shut off. So he got that going again. Started dragging some more. Picked up and went on the stern and helping his crew pick out. And he noticed the boat started going around one way and he started running for the pilot house. And the pilot had hung up. Carried the boat around one side. And when the quadrant's supposed to stop the rudder in the back, well, it did. It stopped the rudder, but the pilot didn't stop.
This is the automatic pilot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it tore up part of the dash and ripped all the pilot out of the floor.
Mm.
This is all in one night. So he believes in all that kind of stuff anyway, pretty much. So he said, there's something on this boat ain't supposed to be on here. So he got to looking. And he hunted all over the boat, and he got up on top of the pilot house, and there was a line of shells on the pilot house that his deckhand had put up there to dry off good. And he said them shells were reading he had all that trouble.
Huh.
Throwed them shells overboard, went for months.
Huh.
Never had any more trouble.
Now, before that happened, did he believe that if you had shells on a boat that
yeah,
that would
he
be
believed
bad news?
It. Yeah, uh-huh. He definitely believed
yeah.
it. He believed all that superstitious stuff, every bit of it.
Now, what about this one about alligators? Are there any stories about how that got started?
Nope, I don't know how that got started.
Mm-hmm.
That's just always been a fisherman's tale ever since I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, what if you were on a boat and an alligator got in your nets or something? What how would you describe it? I mean, if you didn't want to use that word.
Well, I guess an alligator won't ever get in you, in your net. especially where I drag, you know, there ain't no alligators, but I don't know. I believe if somebody picked up an alligator and dumped him on the deck of his boat, I believe he'd give the alligator his boat.
Well, any types of food that you shouldn't bring on a boat?
No, I don't think there's any types of food you shouldn't bring on there, but there's some stuff that you ain't supposed to borrow off another boat,
yeah.
Which is salt. You ain't supposed to borrow salt.
Mm-hmm.
off another boat. But I've done that before too.
What are other things you can do for good luck? You mentioned putting the quarter under the pilot house. Are there other things that you can do to bring good fishing or good weather or anything like that?
No, I don't guess so. Of course, a lot of people won't go fishing with the bow line still wrapped around the bow bit. You know, if he throws it off the pilot onto the boat, he still undoes it from the bow bit. Mm-hmm. He won't let it stay on there.
So it's not tied up to anything?
Right. So it's not tied to anything.
Are there any good luck or bad luck feelings about fishing on days, certain days of the week, or not fishing on days of the week?
Well, I fished one time on Easter Sunday. It's been several years back. And another pretty close friend of mine, he fished that same Sunday on the Melody Star. I went on up the line a little further than he did. I went on up to Brunswick, and he stopped in Fernandina. Set overboard, and my rudder broke. This fellow on the Melody Star, he set overboard, and he bogged up in mud. Couldn't get his nets up, and they was brand new nets. He had just put them on. This was the first day out. So we had to cut them off and leave them. As far as I know, they're still there. And that's been 7-8 years ago or so. And I brought my boat back to Fernandina by dropping the doors down on one side or the other to hold the boat straight, and brought it to Fernandina, and another boat met me and carried me on into the dry dock. But I ain't ever been fishing no more on that day.
See, when I was out fishing with you there, we were talking about things that influence when you go and where you look for fish, and you were telling me about the weather and things that you look at. Could you tell me a little more about that?
The weather plays a big role in shrimping. Commercial shrimping. There's certain places that shrimp get in a different type of weather. Say, for instance, you go out to the jetties one morning and it's blowing a pretty stiff southwest wind. Well, that tells you it don't necessarily always happen this way, but it tells you in most cases that you want to go southwest on the beach, get close up to the beach, and you probably would do better. If you come out of jet and it's blowing a pretty good stiff northeast wind, you can go northeast or southeast, but you want to go offshore into deep water. And most of the time, you'll do better that way. When the wind's blowing out of northwest, turn your boat back around and go at the dock and make you another cup of coffee, because you ain't going to catch a thing. It just dries it up completely. Northwest wind is a bad wind on shrimping. I don't know why, but they just, you don't catch no shrimp.
Mm-hmm. Are there other things apart from the wind that you pay attention to?
Lightning. If you're brownie fishing at night, it can start lightning real bad, and the brownies, it spooks the brownies. I don't know where they get above the nets or bury up. I don't know which.
Mm-hmm.
But I know they'll disappear. I'm talking about it only has to lighten just a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just disappear within a matter of 15-20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They're just gone. So the lightning has a lot to do with it.
If there are other fish in the water or dolphins or anything, does that tell you anything about how fishing's going to be?
You could pretty much bet that you're going to have some pretty good northerly winds if you see what we call spinner sharks. You'll jump straight up out of the water and just twist around and fall back. When you see them start doing that, it's the weather coming, you know, somewhere. And the seagulls, if you see the seagulls start flying real high, you can bet there'd be some weather coming. Well, they can tell it before the weathermen can, I believe.
What about like shapes of clouds or the way the sun is shining on the water? Are there any things like that?
Well, if it's at nighttime and you see a haze around the moon, you can believe that it's going to be some weather coming. Yeah, I seen some weather one time come out of a black cloud.
<What was that?
laughs> I was out there dragging, and this black cloud started coming up out of the west, and it looked like he drawed it, just a straight line. And Shorty was on the boat with me, Thomas. I call him Shorty.
Yeah.
Always called him Shorty. Because he's short and donkey, you know. Well, I told him, yes, I believe it, we might get some kind of weather out of that, because it was kind of a green tint. And directly we seen that tail start coming out of that straight line cloud. And it was a tornado, and before we could get picked up and get back to the dock, there were five of them right around the end of those jets. Tornadoes, or water spouts, they call them out there, tornadoes. It's all the same to me, you know, it's one and the same. So you get some bad weather out in black straight line clouds.
Well, what happened to you? Did you get into any trouble that time?
No, didn't get any trouble. You know, we just picked up and got on into the dock as, you know, as fast as we could get there.
Yep.
I don't normally wait till the last minute.
You ever had any bad luck with storms or rough water when you were fishing?
I've been in a lot of rough water.
Yeah.
I don't guess you'd say bad luck, you know, because if you intend to commercial shrimp, you're going to get into some bad weather. You know, sooner or later,
right,
you're going to get into some bad weather. And I've been out there when it would roll up on the deck and roll off the sides.
Mm.
You know, but I wouldn't stay that long out there. I'd be trying to get back, or either I would be catching shrimp and it would catch me before I could get in. But
can you tell me what a typical year of fishing is like for you from the time you start fishing till the time when you stop fishing for the year? Like when you'd start, the things you do, and right around the year, the type of activities that you would normally do?
Well, we mostly don't start really fishing until June. But we'll start in June, and we'll wind it up sometime in last of January, or maybe the first week in February. Sometimes you'll catch a few shrimp, but in between those times, you pull some maintenance on your boat that you put off.
Do you fish for the same type of shrimp the whole time?
No. Like I say, we normally start our season in June, but you can catch a different type of shrimp before then. You can start catching a few roe shrimp, which is the mama shrimp, you know, in May. And you'll catch them for 5 or 6 weeks. And then maybe the brown shrimp then will start showing up, but they'll be kind of small. But then you'll be catching a few roe shrimp and a few of the brown shrimp mixed up, and it'd be worth your while, you know, dragging, even though they were small, because you'd have some big ones in them. And then they'd grow up, get fairly decent size. All but this year they never did grow up. You know, they still right now same size as was when you went. I don't understand that, but they are, and there ain't very many of them either. And then the white shrimp start showing up, which is right along this time of year right now, you know, the end of July or first week in August, and a few of the little white shrimp start showing. And then that's your money shrimp. Yeah, from now on to through January is when you make your money on commercial shrimp.
Now, all these kinds of shrimp, do they hang out in the same areas?
Same areas. I mean, where you catch the brown shrimp in June, July, August, September on, you'll catch white shrimp in the same bottom.
Would you fish at the same time of day for all these?
No. Most of the time you fish in the daytime for the roast shrimp. And you fish at nighttime. Not all the time, but basically the brownie is a nighttime shrimp. Mm-hmm. And then your regular seasonal white shrimp is daytime shrimp. You can be catching good white shrimp in the daytime, and as soon as that sun goes down, you'd have to get a search warrant to find a white shrimp.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they just disappear.
Where do they go?
I don't know. Where they bury up, or get up in the water, get closer to the surface. I don't know what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think nobody really knows what they do. Brownies, they don't know anything about. They've tried to study the brownies and see, you know, what their habits was, but they ain't have made too much headway.
Mm-hmm.
White shrimp, they pretty much think they got them figured out, you know, where they go and where they come from and how they spawn and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the brownies, they still pretty much lost.
Mm-hmm. Basically, what is your fishing area these past few years? Whereabouts do you fish and how far offshore would you go?
Well, I used to go up in Georgia quite a bit. I would make my northern trips up to Darien, Georgia, and then to the southern I'd go Daytona, like that. But in the last 3 or 4 years, I just fish in the Mayport area, you know, maybe Fernandina, maybe St. Augustine, something like that in between there, but I don't do a whole lot of riding no more.
How far from the land would you go?
It all depends on what time of year it is. You know, if it's nice hot weather, Bikinis is out real good. You get real close to the beach. With the binoculars. But no, that's a joke. But anyway, but anywhere from 2/10 of a mile to 5 miles. But the average is 3.
Yeah. What kind of depth of water would be in that area?
About 15 feet at 2/10 and about 55, maybe 60 feet at 3 miles or 3.5 miles.
Yeah. I want to, in a couple of minutes, ask you about some of the techniques that you use now, but I'm curious about what fishing was like before everyone had the electronic gear, radios, and Loran, and depth sounders that they have now. How did you navigate and find your way around that?
Well, I ain't been fishing all in many years, so they had quite a bit of electronics when I started, but of course I didn't have any, you know. But a lot of the boats did. When I started off, I didn't have a thing in the world but a CB radio. But if you fish in one area most all the time, like I do around here, all you need is a Loran, you know, to keep you off the hangs. But if you did a lot of traveling and fishing, you need quite a bit of electronics. But the old timers would use a piece of soap, and they would tie a string to it, made with a piece of lead in it, to drop it down, you know, make it go down. And whatever stuck to the bottom of that soap, they knew what kind of bottom that was.
Mm-hmm.
And then they know where the shrimp would be on that bottom or not. Mm-hmm. You know, shrimp like mud bottom. And these sophisticated electronic equipment that they got now will tell you where it's mud bottom or hard bottom or what have you, once you learn how to read it. But, you know, it takes time to learn how to read it, too. But when you ain't got no equipment, somebody may call you and say, where are you at? You say, well, I'm down here off of Crazy House. That don't mean it's where crazy people live, you know. It means it's a funny built house, or it looks funny. You know, it's not a kind of odd shape. So everybody used that term as the crazy house.
Now, why would you need that kind of information? What would that tell someone else? If you say, why would you say tell someone that you're off the crazy house? Or?
Well, he may want to know, you know, what I'm catching and where I'm at catching that.
Yeah.
You know, he may, if I'm doing fairly good, well, he may want to go that way tomorrow. If I'm not doing any good at all and he's thinking about going that way tomorrow, he'll change his mind. You know, well, I won't go that way tomorrow. I'll go another way because he didn't, you know, he's not doing nothing down there now. And, of course, now this new Rand stuff, you know, you tell me, well, I'm on a 200 line, you know, and he knows you at the crazy house.
What are the names of some of the other places like that that are down off where you fish?
Tower House, Crazy House, Three Houses, Road, First Fence, Second Fence, Sharp Top. Now, this is all in a short area now that I just give you these names. I mean, this was within 10 miles.
Now, what do some of those things stand for, like the Sharp Top? What is that?
It's a little building sitting right on the beach that the roof goes almost to the ground, and it's real sharp.
Like an A-frame or something?
Like an A-frame.
Yeah.
It's a little black roof building that sits there on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been called a Sharp Top ever since I've been fishing.
Oh, yeah. And what was the one with the tower? What was that?
It used to be a bird sanctuary or something, I think, years back. But it was built just like a tower, and we called it the Tower House.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they tore it down now, but... you tell anybody who's at Towers, they know right exactly where he's at.
Even though the tower isn't there anymore?
Even though the tower's not there anymore.
Huh?
We still say that. Where are you at? Well, I'm down here at the Tower House, and it's not there anymore. But he knows right where you're at. Yeah.
Are there other names like that where the original feature is gone? Like the fences? Are there really fences there? Or?
Yeah, the fences are still there. Everything is still there in that area that I just telling you about, it, except the Tower House. Of course, it's building up so now until it's hard to even pinpoint where you're at. Just like we was off that year building a boat. When I started fishing again, well, things were so much different. You know, they'd built so many new houses and condominiums and things on that beach, so I was about lost myself.
Changed the whole
picture, yeah.
Now, I remember when I was out with you, there was a water tower that we were heading for, and was there some name that you had for that? Down off Ponte Vedra, I think it was.
Golf ball.
That's right.
Yeah.
I said, where are we going today?
Yeah.
You said, well, we're heading for the golf ball.
Yeah, forget about the golf ball. It's a big old water tank, but it's shaped just like a golf ball setting up on a toothpick. And we call it the golf ball, but it's actually a water tank.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's say in these days, and I don't know if you did this or not, but I wonder before Radar and Loran, if you found shrimp in a particular area and you thought you'd want to go back there the next day, was there any way that you would, anything you would use to help you find that place again?
Yeah, that's the way I used to drag. Because I didn't have all this sophisticated stuff when I started out. I watched pine trees and cabbage palm trees and different colored roofs, you know, on the houses and water tanks. Like, for instance, right there, one spot at Mayport, you can line up the lighthouse and that checkered water tank, and you know you're right on the edge of the dump, which is pretty good shrimping sometimes.
What was the dump?
It's a small area where they dredge the channel out.
Oh, yeah.
And used to, they haul it all off now, I think, but used to, when they'd cut it out, they would put the spoil area, you know, on that side, and we called it a dump.
So these fishing areas had names like underwater, too, that you would recognize?
Right. And we'd line up a house on with a tree, you know, and there's one spot I used to go offshore, about 6 miles. And it was just a little narrow slough. It wasn't very wide, but it was pretty long, but it was real narrow. But you could take this single tree and put it in between these condominiums at Nassau, Mia Island. and you could run straight off out there, watching a fathom meter, and you would fall right in that slough, and then you would know you got to drag north, because you would be right in the south end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you didn't have that tree to watch on that building, you wouldn't know where you hit the slough. You could watch your fathom meter and tell when you get in the slough, but you wouldn't know what end you'd be on. Mm-hmm. You know.
So if they cut that tree down, you might have been out of
luck. If they cut that tree down, I got lost.
See, now we were talking about some of the names like the golf ball and the crazy house. And you just mentioned the dump. Were there other names that you use for fishing areas off in
there? Yeah, right on south of that little area that I was just telling you about was we call Pike's Hole. It was old-time fishermen found that hole, and they named it after him.
His name was Pike.
His last name was Pike.
Yeah.
And they named it Pike's Hole. On down a little further than that, there's a little spot we call the Gut Slough. On down a little further than there, we call a little spot Tower House Slough. And Offshore Buoy Slough. All the little spots that we call little hot spots, it's got names.
What's a slough?
It's kind of like a valley,
mm-hmm.
except it's underneath the water.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be but 2 or 3 feet deep, some of them, and then some of them may be deeper than that. But most of the time, if you got a little slough or a little valley like, you know, that the bottom of them little sloughs is mud. And on the higher parts, maybe sand. And the shrimp, you know, you don't catch shrimp in sand, really. They like mud bottom. So you get down in them little sloughs and catch the shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
And most all the sloughs, you know, is mud bottom.
Mm-hmm. Time to change it again. Let me take a break.
End of side two of tape one of the July 31st, 1986 interview with Charles Herron. Interview continued on side one of tape two.